Okay, thank you. Let me tone this down again. Yeah, so I wanted to tell you a little bit about some work that we have been doing on sand ripples. This is actually a few years old, which is why I'm sort of presenting it in Stone Age technology. But I still thought it would be of interest in this school at this meeting. So there are sort of two main things that I want to achieve in this talk. The first thing is that I want to discuss, tell you a little bit about the phenomenology of the formation of basically two different kinds of ripple patterns, the so-called vortex ripples, which appear under oscillating water flow, and wind ripples, which are shown here, which appear under basically steady-state wind. I want to emphasize the themes of wavelength selection and coarsening, which are sort of two different aspects of the formation of these periodic structures. And I want to emphasize that there is a class of models which have been proposed to describe these structures, which are sort of toy models, but which also come up in other parts of granular physics, in particular in the context of granular gases. So I'm going to go into that a little bit. And the main publications are listed down here. So there are two papers from 2002 where most of the sort of original work that I'm going to describe can be found.
But
what? Yeah, I'm not talking about dunes at this point. But I'm not talking about dunes. I mean, so I'm going to talk about a particular class of models, and as far as those are concerned, I think there is not that much. But I'll be happy to learn whatever you have to tell me about that. So let me begin with an experiment, and this is the experimental setup, the way it was put up in the group of Thomas Spohr in Copenhagen a couple of years ago. And a similar apparatus is also can also be found in Paris in the group of Westfried. So what we have here is a container which has a shape of an annulus. So you have two walls, two concentric walls, and in between you have a narrow slit. And you fill this container first with sand and then with water, and then you drive it in an oscillatory fashion. I mean, there have also been experiments done where this has been driven sort of in a DC fashion. But here we're interested in the formation of ripples under oscillating flow. So we're looking at the case where this thing is driven in an oscillatory fashion. So it's basically rocked back and forth in this way. And the quantities that you can control are the amplitude and the frequency of the driving. And what you find under suitable conditions is that you get these ripple patterns forming. The way these ripples are being observed is also indicated here. There is a conical mirror in the middle of this machine which gives you an image of the whole ripple pattern. I mean, the reason why people are using this annulus is because it has periodic boundary conditions, so you don't have any boundary effects. And through this conical mirror, you can actually image the whole pattern at once, and you can take a video film of it with this little camera, and so you can follow the evolution of this pattern. This is the kind of picture that you get, and then what we're mostly going to be interested in is the wavelength. And so what you can do is to sort of basically fit this shape with a piecewise linear function, and then you can just pick up the positions of the troughs and the valleys. Now, to give you an impression of
what's the scale? You may already mention.
Well, this is probably about this size, okay, and this is probably about a centimeter thick or a little bit less. I mean, I have the precise numbers, but so it's, this sort of tabletop experiment.
And the grains are
Well, you can sort of vary that, but I think they most of the time they use natural sand in this experiment, okay? So to give you an impression of what happens, this is a time series from the Paris experiment. Now, if you start with a flat bed, initially what happens is that these so-called rolling grain ripples form. So basically you have a couple of grains which are rolling back and forth in this oscillating flow. Once in a while, two of them come together and then they start to roll together. And so you form these little heaps which determine a certain initial spacing. And these things then grow in amplitude, and they also grow in wavelength. I'm going to get back to this aspect of this initial coarsening a little bit later. But then after a certain time, which in this case is about 2 hours, you get basically a stationary pattern which doesn't change anymore, and this is depicted
the
here.
Exactly.
The vertical, yes, of course, they're not that steep. I mean, they are pretty, you know, they're rather shallow. I mean, you know, you basically all know what these things look like from the beach, so this is pretty much the same kind of angle.
Is it unequivocal that final state is steady?
Steady.
Rather than just the coarsening slowing down.
Well, that's a good question.
It looks like the penultimate on the right peak is in danger.
Yeah. I think, you know, we can probably say more about that at the end of the talk, because this is sort of one of the things, of course, that I'm also going to emphasize. In principle, through fluctuations, I think this thing can coarsen further, but it cannot coarsen indefinitely. And I think for, you know, practical purposes, lifetimes of graduate students and so on, I think this is pretty much a stable pattern at this stage. Now, okay, so what is the wavelength? It's been known for a long time for these particular patterns that the wavelength is essentially determined by the amplitude of the driving. So you have a natural length scale here, which is just the amplitude of the back and forth motion of the water. And the wavelength that you see that is being selected is proportional to that. And this is again from the work of Westfried and Stegner. Here you see the wavelength of the pattern as a function of the wavelength of the driving for different frequencies, and you see that this is nicely proportional. So A here is the oscillation amplitude, so L is twice the oscillation amplitude going back and forth, and the factor is about 2/3 in this case. Another thing that you can look at is the change of wavelength, that is the stability of the pattern, and that's sort of a theme that I want to emphasize also in the following. So what was done here is to prepare the pattern in a certain initial state. So this is an initial wavelength. And then you change the driving amplitude, and you ask, how does the initial wavelengths change? And what you can see here is that as long as the driving amplitude is such that let's see, now I have to get this right. The wavelength is larger than the natural wavelength that would appear at that driving amplitude. It's stable. It doesn't change. Whereas in this regime, the driving amplitude increases. So here, the naturally selected wavelength from a flatbed would be bigger. And here you can see that the wavelength increases. So this region, in some sense, is unstable under driving at this particular amplitude, and this region is stable. Okay, so that already tells you, of course, that these selected wavelengths are in some sense not unique. I mean, the authors here talk about hysteresis in the sense that if you go down here and then back, you end up at a different wavelength. So these patterns have a certain metastability, and that's one of the things that we want to understand. Okay, just one more thing to sort of give a more of a global picture of the behavior. As I said, the parameters that you can naturally vary is the amplitude and the frequency, and the wavelength is essentially determined by the amplitude. The frequency doesn't matter much, except that if the frequency is too high or if the frequency is too low, you won't get any pattern. So if the frequency is very low, you're sort of just slugging the water back and forth, the bed will remain flat, and the same is true if the frequency is very high, then the bed will just be sort of ironed out and also be flat. But in between, in the region where you do see ripples, you can see that the ratio of the ripple wavelength to the amplitude A, which in the previous case was about 4/3, is always a number which is a little bit bigger than 1. So it doesn't change very much. And the experiments that I'm going to describe in a little bit more detail later were conducted at this point. So this is sort of a natural operating point, a driving amplitude of 6 centimeters and a frequency of 0.6 hertz. Okay. Now, I have to say a little bit, before I come to the modeling, I have to say a little bit about how these patterns are being created. I talked already about this initial stage, but the question is, once the pattern is fully developed, how is it being maintained, and why are these things in particular called vortex ripples? Well, the basic picture has, again, been known here for a long time. This is from a publication of Mrs. Ayrton from 1910 who investigated this phenomenon while she was with her husband on the British seacoast somewhere. He was ill and had to take some, you know, had to breathe the fresh sea air, and she was bored. So she started to investigate this phenomenon, and she was the first one to point out that the important role that vortices in the fluid play here. So the idea is basically that when the water is moving in this direction, a vortex, a separation vortex, forms on the lee side of this little hill, and so you get a water motion which goes uphill, and this sort of shovels the sand uphill, and this stabilizes the ripple, and when the flow is reversed, the same happens on the other side. Okay, so this is basically what drives flux uphill, and basically you can imagine the slope to be determined by the balance between this flow and the, say, avalanching which sets in when these hills get too steep. Okay. So this is the basic mechanism, and you can illustrate that with some hydrodynamic simulations. This is taken from the thesis of Ken Anderson, who ran a hydrodynamic code for fixed ripple profile. So this is just here. There's no sand transport. This is just a fixed ripple in an oscillatory flow. And you can see here, so this is a time sequence which shows how this vortex is appearing here. So the vortex is sort of empty here because the flow lines inside the vortex are not being plotted. But you can see that the vortex sort of evolves here. It grows, and then it gets weaker and weaker, and eventually it will then reform on the other side. Now, the important point about this, and that's sort of the only thing that will really go into the modeling, is that the size of this vortex depends essentially on the size of this ripple. If you have a bigger ripple, you'll get a bigger vortex. Okay. And the size of the vortex, in turn, will determine how strongly these ripples are interacting. So you can see here that this vortex, for example, is sort of shoveling mass beyond. You should imagine there's a periodic array of ripples here. So if there were sand transport in the problem, then this vortex would be shoveling mass away from the next ripple. Okay, so these vortices sort of transport mass between the ripples, and that's really what determines whether a certain periodic pattern is stable or not. So I have another. Yeah, let me show you this one. It makes it perhaps a little bit more clear. So here you see again how the size of this vortex changes as the size of the ripple relative to the driving amplitude changes. So if the ripple is small, the vortex is very large, but it's also rather weak, whereas if the ripple is large, the vortex, in this case, for example, the vortex is basically confined to the slope of the ripple itself. So in this case, again, you would expect very little interaction between the ripples. Okay. Whereas here, there is quite a bit of interaction. So the interaction of between the ripples, the amount of mass that is being transported from one ripple to the other, is not a monotonic function of the wavelength. And that's really
so
the most important.
The smaller wavelength oscillation.
What's that?
The bottom case is a smaller oscillating wavelength.
Yes, or a bigger ripple. I mean, only,
yeah,
you know,
or bigger, yeah, yeah,
only the ratio matters, really. Yeah. What's that?
The scales on your three pictures are different on the bottom.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just step back a second. Are ripples observed if there's a steady wind or a steady flow?
Yes, yes.
So in that case, it would be a totally completely different mechanism?
Yes, certainly you would expect that. Certainly, for example, under ripples forming under wind, typically the wind will be steady, and in that case, the mechanism is completely different from this one. I mean, there are also vortices forming on the lee side of dunes, for example, but they are not expected to be very important for the mass transport.
But even in fluid flow.
Yes.
Also, there is.
Yes, there is also, right. But there, I think as far as I understand the picture is that under steady flow, these ripples will basically coarsen indefinitely, so there is no wavelength selection in this sense. And I think the vortices are not important.
It's quite controversial. I mean, there's no natural wave scale anyway. There's lots of different ideas, but it's not.
That's true.
There's no consensus.
But there are experiments in study shear of
yes, 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 yes.
Sand.
Yes.
You just see
Some French ones, nicely. The French have done quite a few recently. There's some theories for that, mostly lamina. It's completely different if it's lamina flowing with this turbulent.
Yeah.
It's sort of unresolved.
Yeah. The lamina case is
much. So from what I understand, you're saying because of the frequency, there's a locking.
Yes, and I mean, you know, as you say here, there is of course a natural length scale. It's just the amplitude of the driving, and so it's sort of natural to expect that this will select the wavelength of the ripples as well. Okay, so let me describe the model, which is sort of based on this picture. So we're not going to address here the formation of the pattern itself. We're going to describe only evolution of the fully developed ripple. So the typical experiment will be that one increases the amplitude of the driving and looks at how the ripple wavelength changes. And so the assumption is that the evolution of the pattern is by mass transfer between ripples which are already there. And what emerges from this vortex picture is that the mass that is transferred from one ripple to the other is a function mainly of the size of the ripple that gains the mass. So that's sort of, this is of course very simplified. I mean, in principle, it will depend on maybe all the sizes of the neighboring ripples. But the basic idea is here that, you know, if you make this, that the vortex is formed at this ripple. And so the size and shape of the vortex is basically determined by the shape of this ripple. And this vortex, in turn, determines how much mass this ripple is able to gain from the next one. Okay, so that's the basic point here. So we have a transfer function, f of lambda, which is a function of the size of ripple I, and which determines how much mass in one unit of time, say in one oscillation period, is being transferred to this ripple from the neighboring ripples. Okay. So this is actually, it was subsequently pointed out to us, is related to some economic modeling, where you can also assume that if two people have a transaction, the guy who gains the money determines how much money he gains. So this was actually in work by Kubisky and Redner. And in one of these papers, we following a suggestion of Kof van der Veele, we call this thing the robber function, because it sort of describes how much mass one ripple is robbing from the neighbors. Okay. Well, it's a measure of the size. We don't really, you know, we don't really distinguish much between the mass and the
agglomerate.
Yeah, you can, you know, this is sort of discussed more in more detail in this paper. I mean, you can write it in terms of masses or length, but on this level of modeling, it doesn't really make much of a difference. I mean, in terms of just describing the stability of the pattern, it doesn't make much of a difference.
It's quite an assumption that the mass it gains is not a correlated thing.
Yes. I think you could say, I mean, the assumption is it depends more strongly on the mass of the ripple that generates the vortex than on the mass of the other. So we're sort of only taking into account that dependence at the moment. Another point is that this function here is not monotonic. So if the ripple that is creating the vortex is very small, then the vortex will also be small, and there will be little mass transfer. So this function will be small at small values. You shouldn't be confused by the scale here. I mean, in principle, as you can see from the equation, maybe I should just put that up here already. So this is the mass balance equation, right? So if you sort of average this over many periods of oscillation, per time unit, you're gaining 2 times f of lambda I, and you're losing to the neighbors when they rob you these amounts. And you can see that this is, of course, invariant in under constant shifts in f. So the overall scale of f doesn't really matter. I mean, you can sort of shift this function up and down. But the important thing is that for small ripples, the mass transfer is ineffective. For large ripples, it's also ineffective because the vortex doesn't reach across to the next ripple. So this function is non-monotonic. Okay, so it has a maximum somewhere. So I'm going to describe what this curve actually is in the next picture.
Large lambda, do you think it becomes negative?
Yes, and that would mean that you start creating new ripples. So if it becomes negative, that means that if you add a new little ripple in the middle between two existing, it would gain. So in principle, if it becomes negative, that would be the point at which new ripples are being formed.
I'm getting to that.
At this point, just let me sort of make sure that we understand the model. So this is the mass balance. So given a function f of lambda, I can write down this mass balance. And the main thing is that this mass balance equation tells me whether a pattern is stable or not, because you can just, of course, any pattern with a constant wavelength is a solution of these equations, right? And in order to determine its stability, one has to linearize around it. And what you can easily see, I mean, this is like a diffusion equation, right? Except that it has a wrong sign. I mean, for a diffusion operator, this should have a minus sign and these should have a plus sign. And you know, for a diffusion equation, the stability criterion would be f prime positive. So here, the stability criterion is f prime negative. Okay. So let me just write down, because I want to make a list of the models here. So this is a vortex ripple model, and the mass balance equation is this one. Okay, and so if this function has this generic shape that it has a maximum somewhere, okay, so it looks something like this, then the statement is that stability implies, or stability requires, that f prime of lambda is negative. So we have an unstable branch here up to the maximum, and then we have a stable branch on the other side. Okay. And this is sort of consistent with what I showed you from the experiments of Westfried, in the sense that if you prepare a pattern of ripples that is too where the wavelength is too small, it will have to evolve to larger wavelength. But if you prepare a pattern somewhere here, for example, it will remain stable. Okay. But in principle, okay. So this will take some value here at zero. And in principle, as I said, when the ripples when this lambda becomes very large and it crosses this point here. So let's call this lambda max. It should have you should start getting creation of ripples. But the prediction of the model is that here you have a whole band of stable wavelength, linearly stable wavelengths. One thing that is important in order to sort of understand this model, if you just run this dynamics with some choice of f, which looks like what I've drawn on the blackboard, you'll find that. What will happen if you start in an unstable state over here is that some ripples will shrink and other ripples will grow. And so you have to decide what to do with the shrinking ripples, because the shrinking ripples hit zero at finite time. So you have to take them out of the system. So this dynamics, which in principle is very simple and smooth, has to be supplemented by a non-smooth step, which means that if a ripple has length zero, you have to take it out, and then you have to relabel the remaining ripples. That is, the neighborhoods will then change. Okay, so it's a kind of two-step process in that sense. But as far as the linearized version around a uniform pattern is concerned, we see that the stability criterion is just f prime is negative.
Really, this lambda here now has dimensions of L squared, otherwise you'd have to have another lambda on the left-hand side if it's actually a mass balance.
Yeah, you think about it as length balance. I mean, you can put that in, but it won't really change anything. Yeah.
I mean, f can also have dimensionality.
Yeah, but it makes less sense to add up square roots of mass.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the question was, where does this picture come from? So the this model was validated experimentally in the following way, and this was basically work of Markus Abel at Potsdam. And he has an algorithm which allows him to fit models to experimental data. So the idea is basically that you make the ansatz for the model. I mean, first of all, I should show the kind of data that have been used. So the kind of data, the kind of experiments that you do are, as I mentioned, you start the system at some small ripple spacing. And then you run the dynamics, and you see the ripples disappear and the spacing increasing. Right? So these are trajectories of ripple crests obtained from the experiments, from these kinds of video images that I indicated. So the idea is that you want to describe this time evolution with a model. And your assumption is that the equations have this form of a mass balance equation, right? So this is given, the right-hand side of this equation is some function of the ripple size itself minus some function of I minus 1 and some function of I plus 1. So that's the ansatz that you put in. And the algorithm then allows you to determine these functions, okay, or to determine kind of best estimates for these functions. So it's I wouldn't be able to describe to you how this is done, but this is just some machinery that you can use. Now, the first check for the consistency of this ansatz is, of course, that these functions should look more or less the same, because in the model, we're assuming this is a translational invariant dynamics, so these functions should be the same. And this is what is indicated here. So these different data sets here are the estimates for these three different functions, and you see that they sort of have the same behavior, and this thick line here is the average of the three. So this is sort of the experimental output, and the main point is that it tells you there seems to be such a function, and this function seems to be indeed a non-monotonic function of size, which is what the model assumes and which is what you expect from this vortex generation picture.
It means only from the position of the crests.
Yes.
It determines the function.
Yes. Of course, I mean, many runs. I mean, you do runs under different conditions, and you the requirement is that the same function fits all these data.
Is this unique? I mean, I wonder the function is a very precise statement about the detailed force, and this is to be concluded from a very weak input, from only the position.
Well, you see, it's of course limited. I mean, in particular, you don't really know what is going out here, because you never see these small ripples. I mean, small ripples disappear very quickly. Larger ripples, ripples larger than this never appear in the system. So, of course, you can only say something about the function in this intermediate regime.
So if you run a simulation using the function F fitted from the data, do you retrieve patterns?
Okay, that's of course, the obvious next question. So that's sort of indicated here. So what you can measure experimentally, first of all, what is a selected wavelength from a flat bed? Under these conditions, this ratio is about 1.25. If you run the model, you get 1.4. Now, the model is, as I said, is incomplete, because in order to run the model, you need to know what happens down here. Okay, so you just have to, so what is sort of natural to do is just to interpolate it linearly down to zero. It turns out that it's not very sensitive to what you do here. You can sort of change the slope, and it's not going to change much. But in that sense, so you could say, you know, the selected wavelength is a little bit bigger.
Why isn't it the selected wavelength just at the maximum?
Okay, I'm coming to that. The other prediction of the model is that the linearly stable band should be to the left to the right of the maximum. Now, of course, you see here the maximum is very flat, so it's not so easy to exactly determine where it is. But experimentally, you find that these ripples are linearly stable down to about 1.13, whereas the model gives you a maximum of 1.08. So that's certainly consistent. What the experiment also shows is that beyond 1.45, you start generating new ripples. And that would mean that, in principle, this function should actually go down this far at 1.45, which it certainly doesn't, unless it looks very funny on this side, which we don't know. So that aspect doesn't seem to be well represented at all. But basically, I think, you know, these data do indicate that the model sort of makes sense. Now let me answer the question about the selected wavelength, because this is sort of the, on a theoretical level, this is the interesting question. So I'll jump forward here. So the question is the following: given a function f of lambda, if I run this model from initial conditions which are somewhere in this regime, right? So we start in the unstable regime with a little bit of fluctuations, sort of generic initial conditions in the unstable regime. The question is, what kind of pattern do we end up with? Now, notice that there is a whole continuum of stable solutions, right? So in principle, there are many solutions in which you could end up. And in some sense, I think it's quite remarkable that the model actually does predict wavelength selection. And that's sort of illustrated for a very simple case here. But this is something, you know, you can just go back to your office and do this on the computer. just take some arbitrary function with one hump and sort it from different initial conditions. So this is as a function of time, the mean wavelength from different initial conditions. And it sort of converges to a single wavelength. This wavelength doesn't go just to this point, but it goes to some point in the stable regime, right? So there's selection of some wavelength in the stable regime. And this is largely independent of the initial condition.
So really, there's something fundamentally nonlinear about the selection mechanism.
Yes, yes.
You cannot get away with linear stability.
No, you don't. You want it. It depends on the shape of the function. Okay. So to the extent that we have investigated this, it is largely independent of the initial conditions. It's probably not completely independent because, after all, this is a deterministic process. So, but it's remarkably independent. So the question is, can we understand that? And there was sort of one idea that we had in order to explain that, which is the following. So you can think about this model as a particle model. So you just take the ripple crests as particles, and then these wavelengths are distances between particles. And then you notice that you can give this dynamics here a kind of a gradient form. So you can see that the speed of particle I can be written as the gradient of a potential, where this potential is just given by integrating this flux or interaction function f of lambda. Okay, so this is just a mathematical identity. So this is a kind of overdamped dynamics in this kind of pair potential of the particles. And so what state is this going to end up in? Well, you know, it's sort of a natural conjecture to say, well, presumably this system is going to try to minimize the energy. So the equilibrium wavelength, the wavelength that you end up with in the end, would be the minimum of this potential at under the constraint that the total length is fixed, right? Because of there are periodic boundary conditions, lengths cannot be created, so the total length has to be fixed. And if you just do this calculation, you find that this turn tells you that the wavelength should be determined by the Maxwell construction, which means that you simply have to draw a line here in such a way that these areas are the same, and that's what gives you the selected wavelength, which is, of course, always, by construction, then always in the stable regime. Okay?
Should we interpret that statement, total length, as total mass?
Well, in principle, there are two conservation laws here. The mass is conserved, but also length is conserved, right? Both of these quantities are conserved. But
the evolution of lambda is very much presented as a mass transfer.
Yes, so in principle, you should write a two-variable model. I'm not sure if you can do the Maxwell construction in that case as well. I mean, I'm sort of glossing over the difference between mass and length here. Right, but here, since we only have one variable, the main thing is that this one variable is actually being conserved. Okay, so this is, I thought, was a very attractive idea. Unfortunately, it turns out not to be quite right. So, let me just show you. Now we're really getting back to very ancient transparencies here. Let me show you what happens. So, for example. So in order to check this, you have to change the shape of the function, of course, systematically. And one thing that you can look at piecewise linear functions. And so a piecewise linear function has only one parameter, which is just if you put the maximum at 1, then the parameter is just the maximum the maximum wavelength where it goes to 0. So if you run this numerically, you get these points. The prediction from the Maxwell construction is this red line. And you see that it gets rather good down here. And these are interaction functions which are quite steep. So for an interaction function that looks sort of like this, which has a rather shallow initial branch and then a steep final branch, this becomes rather good. But for interaction functions which look like they do in the experiment, that is, they are steep initially and then very shallow, this is far off. Okay. So what that seems to mean is that the system is, because it's sort of overdamped, it's actually not finding the minimum of the energy. It's sort of ending up in one of the other states. What is surprising, however, is that it does end up in a particular state at all. Okay, so this is actually so far still not really understood where this selection mechanism comes from. The only thing that we can say is that this Maxwell construction always gives you a bound on the selected wavelength. So the system will always end up somewhere between here and here. Okay. Okay, so let me. There are a couple of more sort of mathematical things to be said about this, but I think I will skip that at the moment, and go on to another subject. Yeah.
You know, I was expecting the flow velocity to show up.
The flow velocity.
I mean, you're telling me this soon.
Yes. Well, this is basically the frequency, right? The frequency of vibration. That's sort of, well, both the amplitude and the frequency, of course, determine the typical flow velocity. But the frequency matters only in the sense that it has to be large enough so that you can actually dislodge grains from the bed. But it should be not too large, because then you're basically creating a kind of emulsion over the surface, and you're just flattening everything out. So the frequency has to be in a certain intermediate range. But as long as it is in that intermediate range, it doesn't play much of a role in terms of determining the wavelength of the pattern. Okay, so I wanted to emphasize that there are sort of similar models appearing in other granular contexts. And so let me say a little bit about wind ripples now. Right, so this is a model that was suggested even more years ago by Werner and Gillespie, and they call this the worm model. And this is supposed to describe some very simple aspects of ripples generated by wind. So the picture is the following. You have a steady blowing wind. You have some ripples here. And now the only input is really that you say, well, these ripples propagate in the direction of the wind. And the input is that the propagation speed of a ripple is basically inversely proportional to its length, right? That's because the amount of mass that you have to transfer goes as a square of the length in this cross section. I mean, you should of course imagine the ripple sort of extending in this direction, and so the bigger ripples travel more slowly. Now, Werner and Gillespie introduced this model in order to emphasize a stochastic aspect of this process. So they represent these ripples by these little worms, and each worm is a certain discrete number of units long. And now the motion is modeled as follows. The idea is that as this ripple moves forward, this worm, the head of this worm, moves forward by one step. Okay, so again, it's a kind of eating away of these ripples at each other. So this ripple intrudes into the next ripple at a rate which is 1/its size. And the same thing, of course, happens here and here. So this is basically a particle model where you have on each site, so we can label these ripples by some index, and then at each site index, there is a certain integer variable, which is the size of that ripple. And at rate v of lambda, this ripple gains one unit of length from the ripple in front of it. So this head moves forward, and so on. And again, of course, worms which consist only of a head, when they are eaten up from behind, they disappear. So again, you have a kind of extinction rule here. So this is actually the same model that I just described to you, except that it's sort of one-sided. I mean, the mass transfer is only in one direction. And the interaction function is 1 over lambda. Now, that means, of course, that these patterns are always stable because the derivative is negative. However, there are fluctuations. And these fluctuations lead to logarithmic coarsening of these structures. And that was sort of the main point of this paper of Werner and Gillespie. So there is a stochastic mechanism that leads these patterns, makes these patterns coarsen very slowly. And Werner and Gillespie also gave some empirical evidence for that. So this is some data for the wind ripple spacing versus time, both from field experiments, wind tunnel experiments, and simulations. And this is, so these straight lines are sort of the logarithmic behavior that you're looking for. The prefactor here, so the model also tells you that the prefactor, so that the length scale should basically be the grain size, right? And here they point out that the prefactor is typically a few times the grain size. So here it's 4 times the grain size, 6 times the grain size, and so on. But it's sort of the order of the grain size. So what we did, and again, this is something that I can talk about if there's interest, but basically what we found was that this model can, in some sense, be solved exactly. You can calculate the distribution of these ripple spacings, and you can also generalize it to some other functions V of lambda, which again, of course, are sort of linearly stable and therefore give you this stochastic coarsening.
What rule do they allow for ripples to actually merge, or do they always have a fixed number?
Well, as soon as one of them has only size 1, when he's sort of eaten up, he disappears, and then you just relabel the lattice again.
But so there's no mechanism. What about the creation of new ripples?
Again, there's no mechanism for creation of new ripples,
so,
no.
What is stochastic? I mean, they have to coarsen.
Sure, it's irreversible. Yeah, sure, of course, yes. Yes, sure. Yeah.
But because it's logarithmic and you're observing it over.
Yes, I mean that.
Hours you might see.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, of course, that was also the point of this paper, that they said, well, you know, the logarithmic coarsening could well be mistaken for.
The definition of the difference between ripples and U's assumes that ripples have a saturated wavelength.
Hmm.
And that's what some people would claim as the distinction.
I mean, you know, you saw the data. The data, of course, not great. So there are other mechanisms, of course, for coarsening, and there are also other mechanisms for logarithmic coarsening. But before I get to that, let me just show you one more sort of model, which which is formally equivalent to these ripple models, which is more related to granular gases, which we talked a lot about last week. And these are these flux models for compartmentalized granular gases. I guess most of you are familiar with this. This is a way of looking at clustering in granular gases, which was invented by Jens Eggers a couple of years ago, and which was then generalized to these multi-compartment systems by Lohse and collaborators. And the point I just wanted to make here is that formally, this is very similar to what these ripple models do. So this is the ripple model, and here I should also say that, as I mentioned, this is this rule has to be supplemented by extinction. So when a ripple has size 0, it goes extinct, right? Now these flux models for granular gases, I don't know how familiar people are with this stuff. I mean, this is there the idea is the following. You have these particles in these boxes. You shake them, so you make, you know, you induce you introduce some energy, so these particles are moving around, and there are these little gaps between in these walls, so that particles that are sufficiently energetic are able to hop from one compartment to the other. And so the flux model simply is a mass balance model for the number of particles in box I. Okay, so obviously this is essentially the same as here. So if F is the flux from box I to box I plus 1, then you can just write this as, you know, F, well, let's give it a capital F maybe, F of ni plus 1 plus F of ni minus 1 minus 2 F of ni. The difference is, however, that in this case, the flux depends on the box where the particles come from, right? Because basically, and this is something that you can calculate from kinetic theory, given that this gas is at a certain density and a certain granular temperature due to the driving, what is the fraction or what is the flux of particles that are able to go through this little door here? Okay, so this flux function F can be calculated from kinetic theory. Again, here you see that the stability is, of course, the stability of the uniform state is determined. So stability would require here that F prime should be positive. Okay, so this is stable if F prime is positive. But kinetic theory tells you again that F is not a monotonic function. So the flux function here that you can calculate looks basically something like this. And the idea is that if there are, you know, obviously if there are too many particles, there are too many collisions, the gas gets very cold and the particles are no longer able to get to the next box. And so you see here that the stable state is at small fillings, and if you sort of increase the density sufficiently, you go into this unstable state, and this is what is seen here. So then you start getting clustering. Okay, so certain boxes contain many particles, other boxes contain no particles, and as this goes on, the number of filled boxes decreases. So this system actually also coarsens. So you get a coarsening behavior. And the coarsening is not surprisingly essentially determined by the tail of this function, because you get clusters, fewer and fewer boxes with more and more particles, higher and higher density. So you move out into this tail. And since this tail is basically Gaussian, so this goes as e to the minus n squared for large n, you find that the coarsening is sublogarithmic. So the typical number, OK, I shouldn't call this. Let's see. Yeah, we can. This is probably the size that the mass in the largest boxes goes as a square root over log. So let me show you. This is a simulation of this flux model, and you see you start with this initial condition, and then you still have certain boxes which have a lot of particles, and there are fewer and fewer of them. And here, for example, this is a typical late time event where this box is sort of being eaten up from the two neighbors and eventually disappears.
Isn't there some extremal nature where it's the smallest box that's going to be eaten first, or the biggest, a little bit like in Landau Ginzburg 1D, where you get logarithmic, not certainly from the.
Well, here, what is important is, and that's of course different from the ripple model, there's no extinction here. So if a box is empty, it's still there, right? So that means that in this situation, for example, in order to coarsen further, in order for this, you know, you actually have to get the mass to go from here to there. So you need a little bit of mass also in the intervening boxes. So it becomes, I think, in that sense, sort of Lifshitz-Slossov-like, in the sense that you sort of have to diffuse the mass from the big to the from the small to the big ones. Yes. But it's even slower because of this. And of course, you know, in the model you can put some other tail, and you would get another kind of behavior. This is actually in non-equilibrium statistical physics. These kinds of models are also known as zero-range processes, and there is a lot of interest right now in condensation in zero-range processes, which is basically the same thing here. So, you know, if you have condensation transitions and you're interested in how these things actually coarsen. Okay, so this is the kind of analogy that I wanted to point out. Now let me finally yes, I think we don't need to go into that at the moment. So let me finally mention a connection to sort of other kinds of modeling approaches. These mass transfer models that have been used for these sand ripples in these two contexts, of course, are not what people write down in order to describe surface patterns in sand. It's in some sense more natural to try to write down some continuum equations for these patterns. And so it's interesting to think about what these continuum equations can do, what these mass transfer models cannot do, and vice versa. Now, one way of writing down these continuum equations is to look at the symmetry of the problem. Of course, you can also derive them. I mean, people have done a lot of work in writing down coupled equations for the sand transport and the surface morphology and deriving sort of long wavelength equations from those. But usually what comes out in the end is more or less also what you would guess on the basis of symmetry. Let me just sort of do this exercise for the vortex ripple situation. So suppose we have a sand surface under an oscillating flow, and we can ask what are the symmetries that an equation describing the surface of such a sand pattern should look like. So there are a couple of symmetries that are required. The first one is that there should be conservation of mass because there is no, you know, net deposition or evaporation. There should be translational invariance in the height direction. If you just change the position, the overall position of the sand surface, it shouldn't change the dynamics. Because the flow is sort of going back and forth, there should also be, on the average in time, a symmetry x to minus x. The pattern is probably not symmetric under h to minus h. I mean, you can see that in these experimental pictures, and there's no reason why it should be that these, you know, ripples more or less look like this. I mean, the crests are rather sharp and the valleys are rather diffuse, so you don't have h to minus h symmetry. You want something to destabilize the flat bed, so you need some sort of uphill mass current. But you also want a stable slope at the end. You want something like slope selection. So on the basis of this, you can write down an equation that has all these properties. And this is sort of the minimal equation that you would need. So h of x and t is now the height of the surface. You can see that this can be interpreted as an uphill current. You see that this gives you an instability because if you put it on the other side, it has a negative sign. This term breaks the up-down symmetry, and it's sort of the lowest order term to break the up-down symmetry that you can have under conditions of conservation. And this term here allows you to balance this term for large enough slopes so that you get a selected slope. In this case, the selected slope would be 1. Finally, this term here, and that's actually a point that is sort of merits discussion probably, this term you have to add in order to make this equation mathematically sensible. I mean, this is something that Bjorn probably, I mean, you would probably disagree with that. But in, you know, in the field where I come from, if we want things to be smooth at small scales, so therefore we put in this thing as a regularizing term, okay? And these two together will then also determine the initial wavelength of the instability. Now, this equation has been analyzed in great detail by Paolo Politi in a different context, and what he shows is that this equation shows logarithmic coarsening in the absence of noise. I mean, it's basically like, many of you will be familiar with this, like one-dimensional Kohn-Hilliard theory, which coarsens logarithmically in the absence of noise and with a power law in the presence of noise. In this case, the power law would be t to the 1/4. You could try to relate that to experiments on these vortex ripples. So this is from a more recent work from the Westfried group, where they look at this intermediate stage, which I haven't discussed here, between the formation of these rolling grain ripples and the establishment of these vortex ripples, where they actually do see quite reasonable logarithmic coarsening. Okay, so this is quite
looks rather good, certainly better than the wind ripple data that I showed you before. So this might be, you know, on some level, perhaps be consistent with this. Although, of course, here one believes that the coarsening at the end stops and you actually do get a selected wavelength. And the point is that these equations here will not give you that. Okay, so this equation gives you unbounded coarsening. But in fact, and I wrote this, you know, several years ago, but so far this conjecture still upholds in the sense that if you have conserved one-dimensional equations of this type, you cannot make them support periodic stable solutions. The alternative to coarsening that you can get by introducing higher order nonlinearities is unbounded steepening. So you can construct equations which do have fixed wavelength solutions, but then the amplitude will diverge. So they will not have a finite amplitude.
How can you get soliton type solutions?
I mean, this is, you know, basically just an empirical fact, because these equations have been studied a lot in various contexts. And it turns out you can actually get, and this is a rather recent development, you can get stable periodic patterns if you give up the conservation constraint. So if you allow for non-conserved terms, then you get equations which are either of the Kuramoto-Sivashinsky type or things related to that. And in these equations, it's actually has been shown that there's sort of an intermediate parameter regime where periodic solutions exist. So there are the generic behaviors in the non-conserved case is, again, either coarsening or chaos. But between coarsening and chaos, you also have a regime where these equations do show stable periodic solutions. But if you insist on mass conservation, of course, you could say for these vortex ripples, mass conservation is probably not really there, because you have, on the scale of the pattern, you know, you do transport mass over rather large scales from one ripple to the other. So maybe one should give that up. But on this level, these equations are not able to describe periodic solutions of a fixed wavelength. Yeah. Well. Okay. Yes. You could. Of course. You could. And if you're, you know, if you're more careful, you could put adorn all these terms with parameters, but then you can, most of them you could sort of scale out, right? I mean, if you scale height, length, and time, then you can get rid of three of these parameters. I think typically, in this case, there should be one parameter left, which I have also left out here. But it turns out that the qualitative behavior of the equation actually doesn't depend on that. So it will, the asymptotically, it will always behave the same way. I mean, if you make this parameter small, for example, then, you know, the asymmetry of these ripples will only become apparent when they get very big and so on. But basically, as soon as you have such an equation, you can usually scale out most of the parameters in the problem.
So if I believe your conjecture, then most modern cars would be in trouble unless they detect the CO level in the exhaust by a so-called lambda gate, which actually monitors the spontaneous corrugation wavelength of the polymer membrane,
mm-hmm.
which is very stably selected by the CO concentration.
I'm not saying that there are no natural processes that produce such a, I'm just saying this kind of equation will not do that.
And this might be a result, this is probably a result perhaps that it's essentially it's a local equation of actually you might expect non-local effects.
Yes, sure. Sure, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, what discouraged you from putting a HXX brackets or square in there?
HXX? Well, that wouldn't be conserving, right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Okay, I think this is actually, these are the main messages that I wanted to convey. As I said, I have some material on the details of what these models do, but I don't think that's really very relevant to the granular part, so I think I'll just stop there and thank you for your attention.
With 8 hours of jet lag, I'm remembering the schedule on the hoop. I think we don't have an event scheduled for tomorrow. There was one in earlier versions. Is that, can anyone corroborate that?
Langer?
That's on Thursday. Yeah.
That's yeah. The program seminar.
At one point, we were going to do an earthquakes thing. John was still here, but he left. I guess on the weekend. John, you're with me.
Yeah, that was a different thing, I think, that was at one point scheduled for tomorrow.
But then I said, since John was here, we're going to do that. Yeah. And it turns out, as I told you, I think, the person who's working on the control side, if people are interested, then we'll do something when they are here.
Yeah. And someone is down for Friday.
Jerry.
Some of us are getting together this evening, and we have to put to bed the official KIGP advertised part of the program for next week. So do come forward with views about next week. Any right now. Well, not only me. Somewhere that's public. I'm sure people do.
I'm sorry, I missed that. For next week?
For those of you who have just come in, please appreciate that at least events that we advertise officially through KITP's calendar, we have a coffee deadline of noon on Wednesday. Limited number of us will get together this evening and discuss that. This means although things a week from now might seem like eternity under the cosh to decide the headlock aspects of that by noon and two. Things might be coordinated as well as a more little fact. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Some tables are not really stable. I mean, they're stable in some statistical sense. Some tables are not really stable. I mean, they're stable in some statistical sense, but you expect them to change once in a while, or the alternate himself, and be destroyed, and so on. So don't you have to add noise to this system?
Yes, I mean, that's okay. There is. There are sort of two various levels on which you can discuss this. I mean, as far as I can understand, natural sand ripples, if you have a bed under steady wind, the pattern will tend to become more and more regular as time goes on. Okay, so you know, initially there will be sort of topological defects, but they will move and they will tend to heal out. At least that sort of was my impression from the reading the literature. And of course, under natural conditions, the wind is never steady. So of course, the pattern changes when the wind changes, right? But that's of course something that we cannot really address on this level. However, it is believed that I mean, there might be slow coarsening going on even over very long times, but that's, as we discussed, is apparently not really settled. Now for these vortex ripples, of course there is also a lot of noise, but the point is that because the system is sort of linearly unstable here, it doesn't really matter if you put in noise. I mean, if you put in a little bit disorder in the initial conditions, it will sort of rapidly evolve to a stable state, and the same thing will happen if you add noise. So for that particular problem, noise will not have a big effect. Of course, it will have an effect once you're here, because then rare fluctuations can again cause ripples to disappear, and so you might, you know, slowly move further out. But that sort of happens on a completely different time scale, so it's not really necessary to take into account here.
In this case of this clustering of Gaussian experiment, there was a sort of a physical picture by which you can derive the flux functions.
Yes. Well, you can actually, I mean, more than that, you can derive it from kinetic theory.
Yeah, within an approximation. But
yeah.
What are the prospects or where are the state of affairs as far as trying to derive this edge from a really physical picture, say, this vortex structures?
Well, you can. Basically, you can measure it in a hydrodynamic simulation, right? I mean, that was also, you can try to measure it. That was also done by Anderson and co-workers. So you can just do the kind of hydrodynamics that I indicated, and then you can make, then of course you have to make some assumption of how the fluid couples to the sand bed, and that way you can sort of determine the amount of mass that is being transported. And again, you get, you know, you get something that is sort of non-monotonic. It looks similar to what is also found experimentally.
But theoretically, I mean, maybe a step further, you know, try and carry that from simulation to sort of an analytic theory of this.
Well, I think what you really, I mean, given this function, what you really need to understand is how the selection occurs. And since you're asking, I think I do want to take the opportunity to show you one more transparency about this, because that's, I think, particularly you could be interested in that. So we actually try to approach the problem by making it even simpler. Okay, so we said, well, if we can't deal with a non-monotonic transfer function, let's do a monotonic transfer function. Okay. A lambda to some power gamma. Now again, if gamma is negative, this is stable but coarsens by noise, and this just changes the prefactor. If gamma is between 0 and 1, you get a kind of power law. I mean, this becomes actually very close to some aggregation problems that Krapivsky and Redner have worked on. But just to sort of show you, you know, how complicated this is if you try to do it properly. So the simplest thing you could think of is doing is to say gamma is equal to 1, right? So the flux is just linear in lambda. This is, of course, unstable. But what you would expect is that you have some sort of evolution of the pattern towards larger wavelength. And this we found we could solve in a mean field approximation, where you simply say, well, we assume that the neighboring ripples have the mean size, right? So this then becomes very explicit. And you can do everything, but in the end, okay, and things sort of depend on the extremal statistics of the initial distribution. So the mean ripple size always goes exponentially, but the coefficient depends on the initial distribution. But it's sort of in this sense non-universal. It does depend on the initial distribution. If you do the same thing for the full problem, the one-dimensionally coupled ripple problem, you find that there is no such dependence on the initial distribution. Okay, so even in this extremely simple case, we can't really solve it exactly, and we don't really know at this point why it's universal in this setting and not universal in this mean field setting. So,
in the experiment, is the apex angle essentially the angle of the closed material?
I can't tell you, actually. I would think that that's sort of what limits it.
That's what you'd expect.
Yes, yes. Yes, I think that is what limits this angle. But
it's interesting because, I mean, for this vortex thing, if you've got a flat bed, there won't be any initial separation, and small deviations wouldn't give separation.
Yes, right.
Presumably, you need a minimum.
Exactly. Yes.
You have to have a sharp enough hill somewhere.
Right.
To trigger the whole process.
So that's why it's a nonlinear process. I mean, what you can get from linear stability analysis is the initial wavelength of these rolling grain ripples. So the rolling grain ripples start at basically, you know, zero amplitude, and they coarsen, and at some point the rolling grain ripples induce the formation of these separation bubbles. And what you can see is also that at that point the evolution speeds up. So this logarithmic coarsening is sort of within this initial stage, but then once the vortices form, there's a new time scale, and then it goes much faster. So for that reason, you can't really determine the wavelength of the vortex ripples from an analysis around the flat bed, because it's very far away from that. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think to take you back to the two-dimensional sound ripple problem.
Yes.
And that's good. If just realize that this logarithmic repeat coarsening is very slow, defect annihilation in the two-dimensional problem is a rival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And you must be able to put a bound on how low the density of defect must be for this log T coarsening to win.
Yes.
The
yes.
And I suspect it's rather strict. I've done the calculation in my head.
Yeah. There has Werner has actually done some work also on the defect dynamics of these two-dimensional patterns. But I'm not sure to what extent that is.
Wasn't it termination? Those lines that just terminated.
In the
Well, the experiment, this is, the experiment were just time-dependent pictures of a 1D pattern. I didn't show any 2D patterns, right?
Oh, okay.
But I mean, I can, you know, there are, of course, there are also two-dimensional vortex ripple.
And then you have annihilation.
Simulations or experiments. I have one. I should have one transparency which I could show you. I can find it. In fact, there is quite a, this is also from Thomas Bohr's group. So this is, these are 2D vortex ripples. And what you can see here, I mean, it's sort of an interesting point because, I mean, not with respect to the coarsening, but with respect to the change of wavelength, because in 2D, if you try to change the wavelength, you also have an alternative mechanism to the annihilation of ripples. Of course, it's much more difficult to annihilate ripples in 2D. But what happens in 2D when you try to increase the driving wavelength is that you get this kind of you get a kind of meandering instability. So the ripples become wavy, and then they can sort of reconnect where they meet, and that way they can eliminate every second ripple. So what actually happens is that you have this wave instability, which doubles the wavelength. Now, of course, that could be too much because you want to increase the wavelength, but maybe you don't want to double it. So then you might have to create ripples again. So I think actually in this case you see the converse. So here you start creating new ripples, so you sort of double the wavelength, but then you get a secondary wave meandering instability to go back at least locally to eliminate some further ripples and to get the right wavelength. But here you can clearly see that in 2D, you know, the two-dimensionality allows you to have more complicated scenarios of changing the wavelength of the pattern, which is related to defects.
Just back in one dimension. Is it, given that you've got logarithms here, logarithm of time, then it gets rather harder to rule out the particle size.
Yes.
Can it be ruled out at the grain size, not the relevant.
Okay, for this coarsening model of the wind ripples, it should be the grain size. I mean, at least that's what Werner claims, that it is the grain size. For the rolling grain ripples, it's also the grain size. You know, this initial stage of the formation under oscillating flow. I mean, this is what Westfried have shown. I mean, they just did this with different sizes grains, and they can see that the initial wavelength is proportional to the grain size, or depends on the grain size at least. But the final wavelength doesn't. Well, the final wavelength is essentially determined by this amplitude of the water driving. So that becomes independent of the grain size, because there, you know, it's just hydrodynamics basically.
So it's only in the beginning that you see the logarithmic roughening, and then it switches over to a polynomial.
Well, for the 1D vortex ripples, apparently there's an intermediate stage where they establish themselves, where you see logarithmic coarsening, but eventually you just get a fixed wavelength, so the wavelength doesn't change anymore.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the roughening. You know, it's interesting that you're getting different results from the numerics and the analysis for this equation, because if this is just linear, it's a backward equation. You know,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
So you're going to magnify.
But the problem in the analysis is that it has this, you know, there is this extinction step. So you're not, if you imagine this as a set of coupled ODEs in some space, every time a ripple disappears, the space changes, right? You sort of project onto a lower dimensional space. And this is something that I think is mathematically, if you really want to take it into account, it's highly non-trivial. So we've only been able to do that on this mean field level that I briefly described. But
I'm just talking about the round of errors in your numerics.
Oh, the round, well,
magnify, you know.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's really a serious problem.
Well,
it sort of changes, you know, the point is that since it's sort of more or less where you end up is more or less independent of where you start, even if you get, you know, in this early in this unstable regime, you add some errors, it's not going to change much where you end up.
No, it doesn't change where you end up, but it means that you're a bit bigger noise on a small particle scale.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then that's being saturated by the moment.
Sure, yeah.
There's also experimental evidence that this causing imposes cancers of the light.
Mm-hmm. This has been investigated by Rebert and Kuhler, by the work also by the Paris guys. Well, they did something that's very trivial. They compared the state with only one heap in an annular container, which was described here, and investigated evolution. Turns out that this one heap dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
In a very slow scale, they form two heaps, and eventually four heaps. Mm-hmm. The mean that this is not only mm-hmm. the perfect roughening. Process,
I mean,
if you look at the long term,
then. The equation rather than being mean field, the independent interval approximation, you tried something like that.
No.
What do you think, Eli? I mean, you should be able to analyze that with the independent BIIA, right? Because that would give you sort of something slightly better than mean field, right?
Maybe, but I think there are interactions the way when you do this mapping to sort of Hamiltonian system,
mm-hmm.
you have interaction.
So sure, yeah, yeah.
You can see a strongly interactive system.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I think we're hitting the 1.5 hour. Everyone needs to be excited about it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Meetings talking, discussing.